to episode 50 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast. So we're recording this February 4th. Mm-hmm. And
Patrick has just updated our website. And so
A couple of days ago. So just the administrative stuff, there's not much. Mm-hmm. I noticed, so all the podcasts are up.
Oh, nice.
I noticed on the last one there was this really weird ticking buzzing noise I couldn't get rid of. So, sorry. I think it will be set up. We just tested the microphone setup just now, and it seemed like it was working a lot better. So, hopefully. Right. I don't know where it came from.
No, either do I.
A computer thing.
Yeah.
Let me check, make sure it's recording. Yeah, looks okay.
Okay. And did you want to start with one of your articles?
Well, you know what I like that we, because we're a lot, we're prepared better this time. Mm-hmm. We used to have, for a couple podcasts, halfway through last year or something, we started doing this thing where we listed the topics.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was really handy.
Okay.
So I know I'm going to talk about, just super fast, about genetic studies in children and education. Mm-hmm. And honeybees and wild bees. And okay. But the big ones will be on influenza and electric fishing in Europe.
Okay. I actually just have one article this time.
Yep.
And it's going to be on polar bears and their lifestyle in the north.
And then at the end, we'll talk about Canaan Valley and drones.
Yes. Yeah.
And
that sounds great.
Work we've done on our 2-meter stuff and
right.
And plans for 2-meter.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Okay. So what do we want to do first?
Okay, to start with, I thought we would go for the honeybees.
Honeybees. Okay, so this is a perspective article, which I don't really understand why, but anyway, it's out of Science January 26th issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's on page 392. And I usually don't give the authors for perspectives, but mm-hmm. this is not tied to original research. It's more of a... it feels like an editorial.
Oh, okay.
And the authors are Jonas Geldman and Juan P. Gonzalez Varo.
Mm-hmm.
And they're at the Conservation Science Group in the University of Cambridge in mm-hmm. the UK, it looks like. Are they both there? Not sure. Anyway, and yeah, so the big thing they're doing is saying that everybody's up in arms about honeybees, and this has been going on for several years. And
right.
And there's been some public outcry about what's happening over them, and there's actually been some huge government programs to try to help the honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, whoa, be careful. Honeybees are a minor part of the pollination that's happening, and there's a lot of wild bees.
Mm-hmm.
And not always, but in many situations, the honeybees harm the wild bees and other wild pollinators. And so some of these programs are ill-advised.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest example is has to do with the fact that some programs are giving funds to help these domestic bees,
mm-hmm.
which are basically like farm animals, they're saying,
right? Right?
Because they're managed.
Right.
Actually, they have this name for them, massively introduced managed species.
Oh, wow.
And basically, you set up these managed bees, mm-hmm. and the crops only bloom for a while.
Right.
And then the honeybees are around and they're looking for food and they're going and they're competing,
mm-hmm.
with the wild pollinators.
Right.
And they had this really interesting view of U.S. versus Europe, mm-hmm. where I guess in Europe they'll take... And I remember talking to you and you said you knew about this.
Well, there's a Netflix special or documentary type uh-huh. that I was just watching. And so I'm just going to check out the name of it because it'll okay. pop up. But you can keep on talking.
Well, it's just that in the U.S., like, these hives are hired out by the farmers. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, that's not the case. So in U.S., for example, farmers will get the hives to come over and be set up around almond trees. Mm-hmm. And then when that season is over, then all those hives will be put on trucks and they'll be carted up to Oregon or somewhere where they help pollinate apples instead. And so for the wild pollinators, that's good because the honeybees aren't there hanging around competing with them.
Right.
When the crop is not in season. On the other hand, you know, if they don't do this in Europe, and the worry is, well, if you start to do that in Europe, you're also going to increase transmission because you got right. a lot more transmission of diseases mm-hmm. from the populations that are kept at much higher densities.
Right.
Right. So.
Right. And in the documentary that I'm still looking for, I'll find in the next 2 seconds, mm-hmm. They were talking about how the honey demand worldwide has mm-hmm. really increased. And there's only the honey quality has also changed as we've gotten better at marketing tastes and taste preferences. So we're able to mimic the taste of certain things. So they were looking more at
they're actually looking at what people prefer and changing the honey somehow. So
well, the Chinese market,
yeah.
they have a honey that's not as good quality uh-huh. because they're putting in these flavors and that
right.
to, and they're like, they're marketing or they're putting on the market more honey than they can physically produce.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so there's big scandal about what are you getting in your honey? Is it true yeah. honey or is it the other?
Ah, right. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
The yeah. other thing was that the honey, people in the honey market, they're putting out hives and that, and there's a lot of competition where people are stealing other people's hives. And so it was more looking at it for food and what is in our food.
Yeah, right? I remember you mentioning about the stealing of the hives.
Yeah.
And then you'd said that they actually can tell, probably, that it's other beekeepers
right.
that are stealing the hives.
Because that they'd have to have that skill in order to be able to take a hive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very strange. But anyway. Yeah. So interesting about just the effect on the natural pollinators. I had not thought about that
yeah.
before. And so I was thinking, bees, they're awesome, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We should
yeah.
protect them.
Yeah.
And then when you start to mention to me some of the highlights from the article, I'm like, yeah.
And this is really, like, there's two types of operations for keeping the honeybees.
Right.
One is to pollinate crops. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is to produce honey. And you can do both, right? But since there's been more funds for the just keeping the bees, I guess a lot more people have started keeping hives in places where there's no crops around.
Right.
And, you know, you have some of these in like totally wild areas where there really should not be any honeybees.
Right. Yeah. And I can, that's, it's too bad that.
Oh, you want to hear a really wild one? One of the competitive, you think of the pollinators competing with each other. Mm-hmm. There's a macaw in Brazil that competes with honeybees for the nesting sites. They both nest in the same types of crevices, same sizes and everything in trees.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's hard to think, to imagine of the bee competing with a macaw.
I know. It's like, I don't think so.
But no, it is.
That is. Yeah. That's bizarre.
Yeah. What are you looking for?
Well, obviously.
Oh, it's the Netflix thing? It's,
yeah, I'll leave it. Mm. Unfortunately, I changed my password in hopes of giving, you know, making sure that I can get on in all the devices and I forgot.
Now you can't.
Like, whatever. But it was a food documentary that goes through different foods and some of the issues surrounding it.
Okay, what next?
Okay, do you want to go into the nurture
one?
Yeah.
Okay. So, before we go on to that, there's one thing about the honeybee article that was really neat.
Yeah.
So, I read this article, and it must have been soon after it came out, because Thursday night sometimes, you can get the articles for the Friday issues that come out from in science. And it must have been that night or the next night. I'm working in the garage, and usually I listen to music, but sometimes I put the news. So I put on the news, and it's a local NPR station, and guess who they're interviewing? One of the people that wrote this article,
I think. Neat.
Yeah, and it's like all about the honeybees and you know how it's really bad in some places and
right.
You need to run. I was like, wow, this is really good. This is something that came out in science, and I mean, these people, they obviously have this agenda. They want people to understand the issues more complicated than we thought.
Right.
So I'm sure they're hitting more avenues than just that one article. But
right.
Anyway, so I thought that was kind of fun. It showed up very quickly.
It is.
Okay, so the nurture thing, a little bit of a, first what it is. It's another perspective article. It was published in Science on January 26th also, page 387. This one does have an associated original research article by Kong et al. But a little bit of the background, you know, we've been fascinated by how strong the genetic twin studies have been and how little effect it seems like parents have on their children and how they grow up, and, which is and pretty much counterintuitive.
Right.
This study, they did something really interesting. They did, you know, now we can do genetics so much easier than before. They did this study of when two parents and one child always. So there might be more children in the family, but they're looking at the two genetic parents and the child, and do the genetics on them and look at their educational achievement. And they came up with this correlation, of course, with genes. But also, there's certain genes in the parents that are not in the particular child they pick, which predicted the level of education of the child.
So a certain amount of randomness.
Well, no, because it's like, imagine you have gene A, B, and C. And your kid ends up with B and C, and they're positively correlated with educational achievement. Then the child does better, right? But let's say you have gene A is also correlated. All three of them are, right? And one of your children ends up with just A, but not B and C.
Right.
They still do better in education, even though they don't have the gene.
Okay, right? Got it.
And so it's predictive. It's not cause and effect, right? It's just a correlation. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot to figure out. But basically, their hypothesis forming around this is that there's a whole environment that gets set up around the child. So that's nature, right? But that environment is set up because of the genes of the parents partially.
Got it, yes.
And the environment might be conducive to learning or not conducive to learning. Not direct teaching of the parents, just the environment they set up.
Right.
And
like how much enrichment.
How many books
experience.
They have around, yeah. And stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Right? You might have a lot of books. You might not necessarily automatically read to your children, but they might be around and stuff. And mm-hmm. the whole concept of life that gets good. Well, so here I'm totally making stuff up, right? This is way beyond. This is conjecture on what this might, you know, different things that might result in this correlation. It's just a correlation, but it's really new to have this kind of data.
Right.
So it's really... it's going to be very interesting because now a lot of people are going to take this into account. Some people are going to use it for their research.
Right.
It's going to help. I guess a big problem in genetic studies of, well, not genetic studies, but in studies of nature versus nurture is what they call, I think it's called population stratification. They called it in the article.
Mm-hmm.
Where you look at different groups, and there's something that is different between the two groups, and it's not associated with the, it's a genetic difference,
mm-hmm.
but you also have a cultural difference or an environmental
right.
difference, and then it makes it look like difference in achievement in education or whatever you're looking at is correlated
right.
with a particular gene.
Right.
Or particular natural environment. But really, it's just that groups are different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a way to help tease this out without having, you know, there's very few
oh, that's interesting.
Twins out there that you can do these where they've been moved to a different family.
Right.
But this you can do with everybody.
Right.
And it helps to tease it out. What's nature, what's nurture.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting.
That's my...
Oh, that's your mouse. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's all for that one.
Mm-hmm.
Those were my two real short articles.
Neat.
So, what next? Wow, we're flying through this.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. If it's a short one, that's okay.
Yep.
Totally fine.
I'm just clearing my board so I can go on to the next one. Okay. Did you want me to go with...
Yeah, the polar bears.
The polar bears?
I actually don't...
Okay.
Do I have them up already?
Yes,
I do.
Just pull up my sheet.
So that one I have not looked at.
Okay. So there's research that just came out on polar bears. The lead scientist is Dr. A.M. Pagona.
Oh, you're looking at the original research.
And... I actually started with a news article and then went back over this way. Basically, they followed 9 female polar bears over a 2-year period.
Uh-huh.
And they had GPS collars on them so they could track how far their movement during that time.
So maybe we should say this is out of February 2nd issue
yeah.
of Science?
Okay. Yes, February 2nd, yep. Pardon me, issue of Science. And they start to look at movement, polar ice, and looking at nutrition because they also had some kind of camera so they could also indicate whether they were hunting and that. I don't really understand
mm-hmm.
the devices they were using, but what they found is the sea ice, spring sea ice,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that it's disappearing faster
yeah.
has a huge, causes them to be nutritionally deficient at those times.
Right.
And
right.
it's not just a few bears, it's like a large number of them. And in fact, I copied out sections of the notes that kind of stood out to me. Like 45% of the bears, or 42% were reported to have lost weight and that their demands were exceeding any gains they were making by consuming prey.
Interesting.
And
not surprising, I suppose.
No, not surprising. But the big surprise was the movement. They didn't expect the bears to be moving as much as they are. and they're a large animal, and they're moving much longer distances than expected. And they feel that's part of that deficient or the deficit is that they're much more active animal than originally thought. Also, just the amount of food that they need to maintain a balance.
Yeah.
Like, they give an example, like in a 10 to 12 days time that for this one polar bear ate 3 sub-adults, 19 newborns, and with all the movement and demands even on its body.
Seals?
Yeah.
Okay.
Of seals, it broke even.
Wow.
And I was just like, whoa, I had no idea.
So remember a
the energy
back.
Demands that it required. Anyway, it was just a real eye-opener for me that the amount of energy required for these larger animals is much greater than...
Do you know how long the study lasted?
It was 2 years.
Okay, so it's not... And, I mean, it's a long time to do research, but it's not...
Yeah.
They're not expecting to see changes happen within those 2 years, probably.
Right. And when they talk about, like, the deficit, with as soon as the ice recedes, their ability to hunt for seals, which gives them that high-fat diet that their high metabolism requires, disappears.
And
so suddenly they are, you know, having to catch up as soon as they lose that.
Yeah, so I'm the reason I asked about how long is because we were watching, was it one of those Planet Earth movies where we had the bear? Right? And with the ice disappearing, the bear was, it looked like, had to do a lot more swimming to get from one place to the other.
Yeah.
Which might be energetically also pretty demanding. So they might actually be spending more energy than they have in the past, you know, like 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Just to maintain.
Because of this, the demands of having to move from one place to another.
Anyway, I found it very interesting because I had not thought of the different things they're mentioning in their article.
Yep.
And it's pretty cool that they're able to track animals like that, that we have.
Well, I actually didn't even have that because I only brought up the perspective. But yeah, that's really cool. More on the polar bear, or do you want to move on?
We can move on to the next.
Okay.
I'm kind of interested in the influenza.
The influenza one? I think that's going to be my big one. The electric fishing is interesting, but so this is again a perspective. And let's see, what page is that from? It's from the January 19th issue, and it's on page 277, and it's associated with just one original research article from that one, which I looked at a little bit, but that was a while ago. So I'm just going to go by the perspective. So these researchers, let's see, who is it? Du and co-workers, DU. Now we can do tons of mutagenesis and genotyping. I mean, it's getting faster and faster. So they did stuff that you couldn't do before, a little bit like the nurture nature children, right? You can do all this stuff. They took influenza virus, which, by the way, I don't know when people are going to listen to this, but we're in the middle of a horrid influenza epidemic. It's been going for, is it like 4 weeks now? I don't know if it's started to come down yet.
No,
in the U.S.
Get this. Last week alone, there were 106 cases at UNC.
Known cases, as we've known said, cases,
yeah,
before.
Documented. Yeah. And in North Carolina alone, there's been 29 deaths in the last.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I think
that includes elderly, probably.
That's
an awful lot.
It was a huge number. Yeah. And it was, I better not say anymore.
I mean, I remember listening to the news, when I was doing that NPR, listening to that, they were mentioning about California and some hospitals having set up tents outside. Yeah. And the number of cases excluding the elderly was, I don't remember what it was, but it was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, not cases, deaths. Anyway, so this is what they did. They took some influenza viruses and they started to mutate it. And then they did this screen of all these mutated viruses to see which ones were deficient in, what do they call it? It's called interferon sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So why is the vaccine so bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons for many diseases where the vaccine doesn't work so well is that there's what's called immune escape mechanisms.
Right.
In other words, the bug's not just trying to attack you, but it's actually doing stuff actively to try to get away from your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. Evolutionary, I'm sure there's
huge
pressure for that to happen, right?
Right.
And the typical one we know about with influenza is the hemagglutinin. There's two viral proteins, right? Hemagglutinin and, the other one is salidase. In influenza literature, they call it, can't remember, but it's a salidase, it's an enzyme. The hemagglutinin has a head region that is super variable, and that's the escape mechanism. By being super variable, then people get immune to one, and then the next virus comes along, and it's got a different head region, and so we don't recognize it. Okay, but there's others.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of immune escape mechanisms, and one of the ways we defend ourselves against viruses is with interferon.
Right.
And the way interferon works is the virus injects its DNA or RNA into you and into a cell. And the cell has receptors that specifically recognize segments of DNA or RNA that evolutionarily it's been set up so that those match ones from viruses.
Mm-hmm.
And they turn on some genes in our cells, which then produce a response, part of which is secreting interferon, one particular type of interferon, secreting it outside. And the one we're going to talk about is the interferon 1, type 1 response. So that goes outside, and other cells sense it, and they turn on machinery that will stop the virus from replicating in the adjacent cells. So when the cell bursts and all the virions get out there and attack the adjacent cells, they're ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the virus is not going to be able to replicate in those other cells.
Right.
But it does other stuff.
Right.
That interferon goes out there and it puts your immune system into
alert mode.
Mm-hmm. So that you're more likely to be sensing stuff that's out there and getting a memory from it. So sensing stuff and then attacking it is what's going to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
But the memory stuff is going to help in the future, right? Because when you get exposed to that virus again in the future, this interferon will make it that you were even more sensing what's out there and making memory cells to handle with it and stuff. Influenza has a protein and has a system, but one of the proteins that we know about is it's called this non-structural protein 1, NS1.
Mm-hmm.
And when it creates that protein, so that's, it's encoded in the virus gene. So the gene, in the virus injects its gene into the cell and starts to get transcribed. And one of the proteins that gets transcribed is this NS1. That one shuts down the interferon production in your cell. And through other mechanisms, shuts down that whole interferon type 1 response. So number one, the cells adjacent to it don't know there's a virus attack because the interferon didn't get to them. Number two, so that's what's happening right there. So that's the immune, one part of the immune escape mechanism. But the other thing it does is that since the interferon's not there, your whole way of getting ready for the next attack is decreased because your immune cells are not activated by the interferon saying, hey, make sure you pay attention. And that's one reason the viruses are actually, the vaccines are not as effective as they could be.
Mm-hmm.
Because you give someone an attenuated influenza virus so you don't get sick, but it's still shutting down the interferon system. So what they did is they made these viruses, influenza viruses, with tons of mutations, and then they screened them for them that the virus, the mutations, had shut down their anti-interferon system. And they call these viruses specifically HIS, hyperinterferon sensitive. With this interferon sensitivity, it turns out that when they inject them back into mice or ferrets, the mice or the ferrets don't get sick. So it's not like it's been attenuated so it's less aggressive. It's that it can't stop our immune system from recognizing it.
Right.
And the interferon is there, so it can't replicate as fast. But what's really, really wild is then they took those mice and the ferrets and they injected them with a second virus under high dose. And let me see which, because the strain is important here. They did this with several strains. The perspective only talks about one. They created the HIS virus, that sensitive virus, with H1N1. And then with some mice, they injected them with high dose of H1N1.
Mm-hmm.
They were protected, no problem. And then in a different set of mice that were also inoculated with the HIS H1N1, they gave H3N2. Different hemagglutinin. Different all sorts of stuff. The mouse or the ferret should have gotten sick.
Right.
And it didn't. Not only that, but when we get H1N1 or mice or ferrets, we create antibodies, and those antibodies do not cross-react with H3N2.
Hmm.
So this is what happened, they think. H1N1 that can't stop interferon went into the cells of the mouse or the ferret, and it couldn't stop our immune response, and so or their immune response, the mice and the ferrets. So the immune response was very good. And usually we only do this immune response to the hemagglutinin head, which keeps changing. Probably the immune response was a lot stronger to all sorts of other stuff. But it wasn't just the antibodies. They think that there's some T cells that got activated as memory cells, which doesn't normally happen against influenza. And those T cells were able to not just recognize H1N1. So you could get a much more broadly reactive vaccine. It's not just that it's more broadly effective, but it's also extra effective against the strain you gave it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So very low number of strains that they tested. You know, there's lots of strains out there. Specifically, they talk about, H5N1. I thought they tested that one. No, H5N1 and H7N9 are avian subtypes that supposedly are very bad for us. They didn't test those, right? So you don't know. And there's some other things that we don't know about, because there's a lot of evidence that seems to say that the antibodies are really important. So yeah, maybe it worked with these strains because it just happens to be that these killer T cells are very good for those strains, but maybe it won't work for others. But it's a very cool article.
Yeah.
And it and it's a whole new way of thinking, because they just looked at this interferon type 1 mechanism we have. But there's others that we have. And these viruses have mechanisms for shutting those down also. So if we can make attenuated viruses that shut those other ones down, then, you know, we have all these targets.
Right.
Plus, there's a big worry, you know, when you give a live virus, it can revert, and then the person really does get the disease. But they found that there were like 7 or 8 mutations they found that would make them interferon sensitive.
Wow.
So you could give your vaccine virus all of these mutations. It's not likely that they're going to revert all of those mutations and somehow.
Right.
And you're not messing up their hemagglutinin encode or anything. So unlike other attenuated viruses that are messed up, these ones are super potent, except for the fact that they can't stop your immune system from really getting at them. So all of the antigenicity that they have is full strength, but they won't make you sick. So I, you know, like I said, there's still a lot to be figured out. We're not sure how good this is going to be or practical, but it's really exciting.
That is. I had actually read it in a news article.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, I remember reading about this.
Cool.
As it came out in a news article. It is. I think this is just a really neat way of looking at treating viruses.
Yeah.
That's a cool one.
Yeah, we might be able to, there's all sorts of things that, we could go on for quite a bit about this.
Yes. Very neat.
Okay. My last one?
Mm-hmm.
This one's actually really interesting also, I think, although it's not as in-depth. We know a lot less. This is, I think it's a this is a news piece. It's out of, it's about electric fishing, which we'll explain.
Oh, this is cool, because I have just read something about this, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not much. It might have been a news piece I heard going to work, too.
Well, it's in the news.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. I think it might be a news piece. I'm like, hold it. I don't think I read this.
It's in the news in Europe a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know about the U.S. very much. The news piece is from January 19th, Science, on page 261.
Yeah.
And so it's about electric fishing. What is electric fishing? Basically, it's an alternative to trawling. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we could be even seen as a form of trawling.
Right.
In trawling, the fishing vessel is looking to catch bottom feeding fish, and they drag this big heavy bar over the surface, which you've told me a lot about that because of your experiences.
It damages the floor bed and destroys habitat for the organisms living there.
And with the electric fishing, So the way it works is they have this bar in the regular trawling that goes through the water, goes along the bottom, and there's a net behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also chains that just drag, and it's to scare the fish out of the mud and whatnot.
Right.
And then they get caught in the net.
Mm-hmm.
And with the electric fishing, they drag a net through the water, and these wires in front of the net, but all the whole thing just, it doesn't touch the ground or it just barely touches it.
Mm-hmm.
and they pulse in the article what they call low voltage, mm-hmm. which I have no idea what that
yeah,
means.
Yeah, I wonder how much low voltage yeah. is.
But anyway, they pulse low voltage yeah. on and off between the different wires, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the fish get spooked out of the mud, and some of them get caught in the net. Mm-hmm. And so that's the electric pulse fishing or whatever. And I think in the 1980s, if I remember correctly from the article, there was a ban on electric fishing. And the Dutch did some research or looked up some research and said, you know, there's some interesting stuff here. Could we get the right for up to 5% of our fleet to do some tests with this electric fishing? Mm-hmm. And the European Parliament, I guess at the time, said, yep, okay, so we're going to allow that. And it really started to work well. And they think it's environmentally a lot better than the trawling. Mm-hmm. I think no one debates that. And so the article says they got more and more licenses. And I can't figure out. They're definitely way over 5% of their fleet. I assume that must mean they got these special licenses for research from the European Parliament or mm-hmm. from the economic, like whatever the administrative branch is. But anyway, the Dutch fleet has now up 75 vessels. That's about mm-hmm. 28% of their fishing fleet that are using this electric pulse fishing.
Right.
And the EU just decided to at least temporarily ban it. Let me see. January 16th, European Parliament voted to ban the technique as a first step in negotiations with the European Commission. That's the actual what it says. And member states. So it's like, wow. Okay. It's interesting. Different groups, non-governmental organizations, view it differently. It seems like a lot of Dutch groups think it's very good, and French group think it's very bad. Those are the examples that I saw, just particularly those two groups, and that's going to come back when I talk about what I heard in the news, which was not in the article. But the argument for is the research really has not shown any lasting effect. There's one or a couple studies that showed that, so basically the pulse cramps up the muscles in the fish. Mm-hmm. And then after the pulse, the fish is like, oh my gosh, swims up, gets caught. There are two types of fish, I can't remember what they were, where it showed that actually, the effect on them is quite a bit larger than on the soles that are normally caught. And they can get some hemorrhaging and some fractures in the vertebra, I think. Mm-hmm. Which may, it almost would have to be in the vertebra if it's the back muscles cramping up. But the effect didn't seem to be long-lasting. What does that mean? Do they mean for the fish or for the environment? That's totally different things. But anyway.
Right.
The people that are against it are saying that, well, it's mostly, from the article, it's mostly this one group, non-governmental organization out of Paris, I think. And they're saying, you know, this is silly. We already know how to stop. You know, it's still causing bycatch and damage. And if you use, they say, gill nets and something else are two other ways of fishing, which substantially reduced bycatch compared to both the electric and the regular trawling. So they just want that.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that that's going to be a lot lower catch overall, but I don't know. One of the worries is that if you ban it, and you've got such a huge fishing fleet from the Dutch countries that are using it, they might go back to trawling.
Right.
Which is going to be way worse. You know, right. That's a local in time effect. In the long term, that's not what you should be thinking about. But it's kind of weird that you'd ban the electric fishing but not ban the trawling. I didn't totally understand
that. Right. That seemed kind of strange.
Well, it might be a historical thing. You can only ban so much that's already established.
Mm-hmm. But, like grandfather clause type deal.
Yeah. Okay. Although it seems like you should be able to phase the stuff out if it's that bad, you know. But, you know, a lot of these decisions get made through negotiations between countries, each one not primarily concerned just with the environment, but with its own industries, right? Which, in a way, is the way it should supposed to be. One thing they mentioned is that the electric fishing is really good at catching these two fish in particular, which is what pretty much the Dutch fishing fleet fishes for.
Mm-hmm.
And the other fisheries also catch those fish, but it's not their main fish. So the economic incentive is not there to switch over to the electric fishing. One of the things for the environment, by the way.
I was just about to mention
about
that.
What?
57% reduction in terms of discarded weight, like of the unwanted fish that are caught up in the nets.
Right, right. So that's the bycatch.
Yeah, the bycatch. Yeah. And also the speed.
Well, that was what I was thinking about, was the news article in Science mentioned that diesel fuel was reduced by half.
Yeah. They were, the number of knots that it takes to pull that gear is much less than the trawl.
Well, the trawl, in the regular trawling, the gear is very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a lot of diesel to go at a particular speed.
Right.
But there's the added effect that when you do the electric fishing, it works better if you go more slowly. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to go more slowly, you're going to save even more fuel.
Right.
So it comes out to about 50% saving for, you know, a fishing outing. So maybe a little bit of side story here.
Okay.
I was listening to France Info.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some outraged fishermen and they were demanding action.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what is this about? They were complaining that their if I remember correctly, I mean, I could only listen on and off because I had to keep turning it off to do some work, but it seemed like they were complaining that the stocks of the fish had gone down and that the Dutch needed to be shut off. And I'm like, what?
Oh,
really?
Wow.
And so now I'm reading the Perspective article. It's like this French NGO is saying, well, this is stupid. Electric fishing should be shut down and so on. And I'm like, and you know, there's this story about the banning from the other countries. And I'm like, there's more to this happening. This is way more of a big political thing than the Science article.
Oh, yeah.
Seems to say, wow. Anyway, yeah, that France Info stuff seem to be devoid of any kind of science behind what people were talking about.
Right. I don't know why, but I was really interested in knowing what kind of charges are we talking about.
I know,
about.
Yes.
And I was quickly looking through, and I could not find it. I could find the amount of difference it had in the overall speed.
Uh-huh.
But not the actual pulse.
Yeah. I'm hoping that it goes on a little bit more because it's interesting. It's yielding interesting research. Mm-hmm. And it's not like everybody's using it. So it'd be interesting to know, you know, is there some pretty serious damage that we don't know about? For example, none of the research on long-term damage has looked at rays and sharks.
Right.
And they mentioned that in the Science article. And they didn't say anything else. But, you know, you can imagine, well, those are cartilaginous fish. Maybe they're more susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
The other thing that I noticed when I was going through is they were saying that the amount of, like, even time is just not the same for, you know, the amount of time it takes to actually pull in gear and that, which makes sense, larger nets.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Certainly, you'd think if the gear is lighter that it's safer for the fisherman. I don't know if that's a big issue for trawling or not.
Yeah. And instead of the heavy chains, which you mentioned for trawling, they just have electric nodes dragging along.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's very different disturbance on the floor, the sea floor.
Oh, I have the types of fish here.
Okay.
So the Dutch are fishing for Dover sole.
Mm-hmm.
Flatfish in general, but particularly Dover sole.
Mm-hmm.
And then other European countries, I don't see it. The ones that have been shown to be harmed by it are cod and something else. Whiting. I don't know what fish is whiting. Whiting.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. The organizations that are for or not that seem like they're should be outside of the fray seem to be divided between the Dutch and, well, the French, there's only the one that's mentioned. There's this guy, Adrian Rinstorp. He's with the Wageningen Marine Research, co-chair of ICES Working Group, and he coordinates one of those big research, EU-funded research programs, supposed to end in 2019. So, pulse trawling is the other word they use to describe it.
Yeah, and they mention in the article one of the concerns is what they're doing in China, where they're putting out much larger electrical capturing systems.
Uh-huh.
And they're just like raking in indiscriminately everything that they can get.
Right.
Instead of going for specific targets.
They must be using larger voltages.
Yeah. Much larger voltage. Yeah. And it was a matter of larger vessels that are at
a, I mean, I think longer. The voltages used were specifically the outcome of the research that the Dutch were doing.
Right.
Because they were interested in the sole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, they managed to significantly reduce bycatch, so.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's just, find it very interesting.
Yeah. You know, there's a certain amount of, okay, these are the fishing countries, that a lot of this research is funded by the fishing industry. But it certainly doesn't seem as bad as the whole whaling thing. It seems much more serious research. And,
I'm really excited to see research like this done on different techniques and using that to guide their choices for what technique to continue with.
That French organization is called Bloom Association, B-L-O-O-M. Mm-hmm. It's based out of Paris, it looks like. And then gillnets, I mentioned. The other one is called just stationary curtains. That's what they call them, not nettings. So,
interesting. Really cool. I remember you telling me about it when you first read it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice.
That's all of our literature for... So, there were some really fun articles.
Yeah, definitely.
Go over what we've been doing and then our future plans.
Yeah.
And wrap it up, although... Okay, so now we're getting back to the fact that this has totally become a website with a blog and podcast that's mostly about ARDF, but that's the way it is. Actually, it's not... We're not going to start with ARDF, right? Canaan Valley?
Canaan Valley.
Christmas.
Yeah. We got snow.
We got snow. That was so good.
That's a big thing for us when we're down further south.
Yeah.
Snow is really spotty.
So we got, and it was good snow.
It was. And we were nice. Fortunate, like, for weather.
Yeah.
We had, like, wonderful weather support when we were there because they were getting rain out on the outskirts of 81, and back in West Virginia, we had snow for all the rain they got over.
Is it Harrisonburg when we leave the highway? Yeah. So I you remember we're driving west out of there, and there was no snow anywhere.
No.
And they'd gotten all rain, and you make it over the first ridge.
Yes.
Into the Appalachians.
Yeah.
And then suddenly on the other side, it's snow.
Yeah. A light dusting.
A light dusting. And then the next ridge, there's a bit more. And So we had a fair bit of downhill.
Yeah.
And then we had a snowstorm.
Right.
And then last day, we got to cross country ski.
Which is awesome.
That was awesome.
Yeah. So we got out for a few skis.
Yeah. Yeah. And Isaac and Carr were with us, which was a lot of fun. We had the cabin as usual.
Right.
So we brought all sorts of... So, for Christmas, the techie thing for this Christmas was the drones.
Yes, yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That's definitely something, if you pick small enough ones, you could just play around with immediately in one day.
Right.
We're trying to do little tricks and...
Right.
Like, raise it up and over this and then land it on here and stuff. But that's a lot of fun.
It is. Yeah. It is. And when we were doing that, we had this little gauntlet for the drone in our hallway. And there were plants lining the hallway. All of them got chewed up a bit.
Yeah, there's one particular plant that got
our plants didn't do so well with the drones, but everybody else did. Yeah.
So thank you to Isaac for the big drone. He really gave us a big one.
So that'll be cool to play with in the spring.
Yep. Let's see. So that was like our Christmas thing. Cross-country skiing was cool. Got a knee injury, which is interesting because usually they're like twists and stuff. But this time it was a...
Hammer.
Yeah. And it's really different. And I still... Yeah. I'm just barely able to bike a little bit. Now it's very interesting. It's gone like... Like there's a hard spot on the side and it's blown up. I don't totally understand. But got x-rays and everything. And you know, that happens without any fracture, it seems like. It's just...
Right.
So, very interesting. I think we talked a little bit about... I was going to get LED lights for Luke's room for the plant. We're not sure. So, we're going to come back to that in the future.
So, we have this very... hippie looking color coming out of our house from one room.
I know, it's like this pinkish. So it's one of those grow lights LEDs that have the red and the blue.
Yeah.
And it basically makes it look like this magenta super strong light out the window.
Right.
at night.
And when you look up at it, it like gives you a green haze.
Everything looks normal.
Yeah.
But then you walk out of the room and everything looks like Joe and the volcano green fluorescent sucked the life out of your eyeballs.
Yeah. So that was pretty crazy. I did not expect that.
We said we'd talk about my new camera. Really haven't done... we've used it a lot to take snapshots, but we haven't really looked in depth about it. So there's not much to say except it's been taking really nice pictures.
Yeah, we will be playing around with it more.
Let's see, what is it? It's an Olympus... Olympus something or other. We just call it the red camera. Olympus...
It's supposed to be the heavy-duty, tough one.
Tough TG...
Right.
5 or TGS?
And basically, we haven't had it out in any rough environment to really know.
Well, we had a cross-country ski.
We did.
So, actually, you got me one of those strap things where you can just hold it on, and we did find out something interesting.
Yeah.
So, the strap things that have the camera and just hold it so you can pull it out, it doesn't protect the camera enough.
Right.
So, if you put it, if you're going to use the camera as a GoPro type thing, and you keep it strapped onto yourself, then that's useful because it keeps the front open so it keeps going.
Right.
But unless you're doing that,
it doesn't.
Might as well get a little bag for it to protect it more.
Yep. Agreed. And we have a working 2 meter.
Woohoo! That's been so long in coming.
Yeah.
We've kind of said that a little bit, but this is very much the final stage. Yesterday, for the very first time, we had the two boards, the transmitter boards. One of them is to make the RF, the other one is to control it. So they're two separate ones now, as opposed to the 80 meter. We had it outside with the type of battery box that that's supposed to be powering it. There was code burnt onto the 18 mega that was controlling it so that it would go on and off at the right times. And it was sending out both the Morse code for the, we tested only the homing beacon.
Right.
But the other stuff was tested inside, that worked. So that's just code. And had the antenna, which was mostly the same design that Jay Hennigan put on his website, which, he's going to come up again.
Yeah.
Later on. In our future plans. But, and we walked away and we listened with our 2 meter receivers, including the PJ2D Chinese receivers.
And it worked well.
And it worked really well. So I was powering it with only the voltage regulator to the final stage was set to 8 volts. Mm-hmm. So we can up it from that. And I could hear it with the Chinese PJ2Ds from 350 meters away.
Mm-hmm.
And for doing a very small school event, that's fine.
Right.
So we're almost, if I can get them built on time, it's not so much development anymore. It's just getting it built. So next month and a half or so. We are very excited for that.
Yeah, that is exciting.
And I wrote a blog piece about that final success, it's not totally written. I've moved the pictures over, it's partially, so that'll go up tonight or tomorrow, I think. I could talk so much about this, but I think I'll leave it about the 6 millisecond timing for that we had changed to the crazy 55 or 60 hertz that the antenna was picking up inside the house. My gosh. I was like, this transmitter is picking out crap as soon as we put on the antenna. And then I turn it off, disconnect the antenna, and it's got like a 5-some volts peak to peak. It's not connected to anything except the oscilloscope.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, holy crap. And it's like 60 hertz. So it's really low frequency compared.
Right.
The audio is 800 hertz. And for the... So this is one thing that's special. It's not just that we're up at 145 or so megahertz. It's that it's amplitude modulated that the Morse code is. There's a carrier that's on all the time and then this amplitude modulation, which the carrier looks good.
Mm-hmm.
The modulation, as you heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit rough.
It needs a little work.
Yeah. But it's good enough, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
it is.
It's that shouldn't cause any spurious emissions. Mm-hmm. It's just what the sounds that you're going to get.
Right.
So,
right.
If the modulation is not exactly a sine wave, let's just put it that way. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's not a square wave. It's not a sine wave. It's like a lopsided.
It's doing its own thing wave.
I think I'm going to call it the. Pompadour wave. Anyway, okay. So that's what we've been doing. And that's we're going to be doing building now mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Future plans. We've got a bit of traveling coming up. Not much. And desperately... I'm going to be desperately working on the school stuff.
Trying to get everything
soon
ready.
Because that's getting pretty close. Our first meet.
Mm-hmm.
And then this summer, the ARDF championships
right.
for the U.S. were announced.
In California.
In California. Truckee, California.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And we booked Bear Island.
Yes. So it should be a busy summer.
Yeah, but a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I think that's everything.
It is.
Okay, should we wrap up?
Yep.
Okay, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure to check out our blog.
Which is back.
Yes.
For real. Goodbye.
Goodbye.